Welcome to the HCI family of podcasts. We're your source for personal, professional, and organizational growth and development. We share our own original research, explore industry trends, and interview executives and thought leaders from across the globe. Join us for practitioner-oriented content around all things leadership, HR, talent management, organizational development, and change management. Maximize your personal and organizational potential with the HCI family of podcasts. Thomas Sterner, welcome to the conversation today.
Oh, thank you very much. It's great to be here.
It is a pleasure to be with you. You're joining us from Delaware. I'm south of Salt Lake City in Utah. And today we're going to be talking about your recent book, It's Just a Thought, Emotional Freedom Through Deliberate Thinking. I think this has a lot of practical applications for us in various aspects of our lives. So we'll talk about that generally, but we'll also talk about this in relation to the workplace and working in teams and trying to be collaborative and whatnot, because there's a lot of thoughts that get in the way of all of that happening effectively in the workplace. So I think this will be a really fun conversation. As we get started, I wanted to share Tom's bio with everybody. Thomas M. Sterner is CEO of Practicing Mind Institute and is an in-demand speaker and coach working with high-performance industry groups and individuals, including athletes, to help them operate effectively in high-stress situations and experience new levels of mastery. Prior to writing the best-selling The Practicing Mind, he studied Eastern and Western philosophy and modern sports psychology and trained as a jazz pianist, and he lives in Delaware. What a fascinating background. Again, thank you for joining me. Anything you would like to highlight by way of your background or personal context before we dive on in?
Well, the one thing I would say is, you know, as for 25 years, I was a high-level concert piano technician. And the one value of that in terms of what I do is that piano work is extremely tedious and repetitious because there's 88 notes. So everything you do on the piano, you got to do at least 88 times. And then, you know, if you're just doing a tuning on the piano, you have about 235 tuning pins that have to be touched at least once. So the value of that for me was in trying to find out how to train my mind to be on a task for hours and hours, because I would at a very high level, because I was working for the best musicians in the world on a daily basis, and to stay fully engaged in the process and not feel like, oh my gosh, I can't stand this. You know, when is it going to be done? And I mean, actually to enjoy the process of doing that. So it allowed me to have a really good incubator to work on all of the things that we'll talk about. That was, I think, one of the unusual things about my background.
That is super interesting. And we've all been there. We've all been there when we're doing, you know, what some may seem as tedious tasks, and your mind drifts and you're not really paying attention. Of course, that can have all sorts of bad results if you're doing something as precise and delicate as tuning a piano or working on a piece of machinery in a factory or whatever. Like, accidents happen, quality goes down, etc. So, I mean, there's practical reasons for why that's a challenging thing in the workplace. And to be able to have that discipline, I think, is something that is a really nicely developed skill.
It was also a stressful environment, because you weren't just tuning the piano, but you were setting up the action mechanism, the keyboard mechanism. And what your listeners have to understand is, at that level, if everything is perfect, the performer is good enough that the instrument will fail. They will outplay the instrument. So, and they're not very happy about that when it happens, you know. So, and it also affects the performance and everything. So, like I said, you had to do your highest level, best work every time. And so because of that, you know, to be able to get into a place where you weren't thinking like, I just can't wait to get done this so I can go be someplace else, It was really good training, and it was a long time.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, why don't you start by just really telling us about the why behind this book? Why this book? Why now? Books are a labor of love. They take a lot of time and attention and energy. Why this book? Why now?
Well, I originally wrote The Practicing Mind in the early 90s. It wasn't published until 2005, and that's because I was in the piano technical business. I tried to get somebody to look at me, and nobody knew who I was, and they certainly didn't know what the book was about, and they didn't care. So I ended up publishing it myself. It eventually, after about 2 years, it became enormously successful and was taken over by New World Library, and has continued to be very successful. And then that's when I changed careers because I could afford to do it. And then that freed me up to spend a lot more time on research. And I was talking about this on a daily basis to everybody, from one-on-one clients to corporate clients, CEOs, all the way down to teams within corporations. So then I wrote Fully Engaged, which was kind of like a follow-up on that. I always looked at it as another seven chapters to the practicing mind. It's Just a Thought was really something different because much of the information that is in It's Just a Thought wasn't even around when I wrote The Practicing Mind. We have made such tremendous strides in understanding through, not just sports psychology, but neuroscience and everything. We really we can measure thought, electromagnetic energy and everything. We know when you think there is something that actually goes out of you. We know this. It's not, we also really have a good understanding of the subconscious mind and how it works. And so I really began to see that our thoughts are not as private as we once thought that they were. The thoughts are, the energy is going out, the emotional energy that's in it is going outside of us. Our body has a neuro system in the heart through HeartMath that is set up to read that information and understand it. And there's all this stuff that's going on around us and is impacting us, and that we're impacting it. And if you don't know that, you become a victim of it. It's a system that is running 24/7, and you can either use the system or be used by the system. So it was really, really fascinating, to me, and I just dove into it farther and farther and continue to. And that was when I realized that, look, freedom comes through deliberate thinking. And most of the time, we are not deliberate thinking, we're being thought. And so we need to understand what it feels like to be thought versus what it feels like to be the thinker of the thought, and then be able to master that process so that we're in control of what we're experiencing during the day.
Deliberate thinking. The opposite of that is really what we end up doing a lot of times, the automated thinking that just starts to happen. It's why you can get in your car and drive, and then all of a sudden, 10, 15, 20 minutes later, you end up somewhere and you don't even remember how you got there, right? We just have so much kind of rote muscle memory, but also just automated thinking where we just naturally do things without, and our mind wanders. And there's a time and a place for mind wandering, don't get me wrong. But tell us more about this, the contrast between automated thinking and this deliberative thinking that you're just referring to.
Well, if you look at the subconscious, the subconscious is a very elegant recording system, and it's not creative. It doesn't have a sense of humor. It's not critical. What it does is it watches how a situation makes you feel. It's how it makes you feel. It doesn't judge how it makes you feel. It just correlates the two. And so, if a situation happens and it makes you upset, the subconscious is always trying to make you happy. So what it does is it says, oh, okay, this is how he or she wants to feel when this situation or one similar to it arises. And so it writes a program for it and it stores it on the hard drive. And then the next time something like that happens, it plays it. And after several rotations of this, it habitualizes it. And the reason, we have habits, habits are extremely effective from a cognitive level. In other words, they're sort of like they don't take any RAM up because they're automated and there's no decision making in them. They just something a trigger happens and they fire off, and then you repeat the habit. So that's not deliberate thinking. And a story I've told many times was, I was working with a CEO one time, and we were having this conversation, and he said, I don't think I buy that. I think that, I'm actually making my choices to think the way that I'm thinking during the day. And so, to make a point to him, I said, did I ask you to talk? I don't think I asked you to talk. I think you need to sit there and shut up until I tell you to talk. Well, of course, he became very insulted. And I said, you see that? I said, you did not make a choice to feel what you're feeling right now because I don't think you're very comfortable. If you had the choice, you would choose not to react that way. In fact, you would probably choose a scenario where this guy's not going to touch my inner peace. And so he was like, he laughed about it and he just said, thank you for the awakening. He said, I get what you're saying now. And I said, well, that's where, our neuroscience says that we spend 95% of our time in our day, basically things happening out in front of us, and we're just running programs. And we're not actually the thinker of the thought. We're basically being, our thoughts are being dictated to us. So we're not thinking deliberately. A deliberate thought is has decision making, and conscious intention behind it. When this situation happens, this is how I am going to act. And that's freedom. If you don't have that, you're not free. You're basically just a puppet to whatever's going on around you. And most people, and that has to, that's for all situations. Anxiety, most people know now that the brain has a negative bias because the brain is not designed to make you happy or successful. It's designed to keep you alive. So because of that, it has a bias towards negativity because it looks at that as something that could harm you. So it has a tendency to go towards what could go wrong here. And that's okay, but you're not your brain. Like, your brain is like your laptop. You should be using your laptop to do things for you, not your laptop running you. So the brain is, should be looked at in that regard instead of the brain being in control. It's doing what it's basically programmed for, but that doesn't mean that you can't override that and train it to be differently.
And so we, I talked to a child psychologist just the other day, and she was talking about how really it's in those toddler years, the first several years of life, where so much of that programming happens, depending on the relationships you have, how you're taken care of, and a lot of that just automated, like how you respond in different situations, is programmed really early on. Now, does that mean you're a victim to your, circumstances early on in life? Well, no, but it does mean you may have to do the work to uncover trauma or the things that impacted you that way so that you can be more deliberate about reprogramming yourself to uncover those unconscious biases and to be more aware of what's happening and why it's happening while it's happening to you. That's a process that we all kind of go through. We unpack things, we try to better understand where we're coming from. When I think about within an organizational setting, there's a lot of talk around diversity, equity, and inclusion. And part of that is, unconscious bias training and just like trying to help people recognize what's going on in their head without them even really recognizing or knowing it, so that you can choose something different, right? So you can say something different, act differently. So you can eventually change the way you even respond to and feel about the things that trigger you, perhaps in the moment.
Yes, yeah, so I one of the things that I work with all my clients is what I call thought awareness training. You have to experience there is a different feeling of being in your thoughts and being the noticer of your thoughts. They're two different perspectives. And in order to change anything, John, you have to get to the point where being the noticer of your thought, the observer of your thoughts, who is really who you are, because when you're not the observer of your thoughts, you're being thought and you're just basically being obedient to habits. So you have to learn what it feels like so you recognize that. And then when you recognize that, then what happens is you can do what you were just talking about. Then you have the privilege of choice. That doesn't mean that the choice is easy because you're pushing against habitual behavior that you've had your whole life, but you get the option. You get the option to make the choice. And then, what we talk about is things like, I may say to somebody, okay, when this situation arises and you get to where you can be the, you live more in the observer of the thoughts, this situation is going to arise. So when it arises, if you could be anybody you wanted and react in it or re respond any way you want, what does that look like? And I always get, I don't know. And I said, well, if you don't know, you're not going to figure it out once you're in the throes of the emotional content of the habit. Like, so you need to have something that allows you, first of all, like a rescue mantra is what I call it. Something you say, like, this is when the fun starts. Something like that, as soon as you feel this something has happened and you recognize, whenever that person walks in the room, I always get nervous. Okay. So when that person walks in the room, you need something to shut down the habitual response of anxiety so you can get out ahead of it a little bit and then execute the new procedure. And so I tell people, let's come up with some sort of a rescue mantra so that you can say that, like, you're going down today. I don't care what it is. You know, whatever makes you feel empowered, that's what you do. You say that, and now you immediately go into whatever your response is going to be. And many times I mention the fact that I'm a pilot and I have a pilot's license, and this kind of procedure is drilled into pilots. In other words, if the engine quits, that's not when you get the manual out and figure out what to do. Like when the engine quits, you have two choices. You can be removed and analytical, or you can scream all the way to the crash site. So, basically, if I have an electrical problem, I'm going to do A, B, C. It's all written out, A, B, C, and D. If I feel like there's a fuel starvation, if the engine just up and quits, if the engine runs rough, if communication goes away, all this stuff has a procedure for it. And so you practice that over and over and over again so that when it happens, you just instinctively go into it. And I can tell you it worked extremely well, because when I was learning to fly and I had to solo for the first time, I was really fearful because I couldn't imagine taking this airplane off in three-dimensional space at 100 miles an hour without the instructor sitting next to me. I just thought, like, if something goes wrong, that's the end of me. But what I found was that we had practiced the procedure so many times that it was really anticlimactic. I mean, it's just, push the throttle forward when you hit 65 knots, start to rotate, climb to this altitude, your climb out VY angle will give you 74 knots of speed. All this stuff was just stuff that I'd done, 200 times. And so I had to do three full circuits. And when I did them, I was like, this is like almost boring. Like, this is not scary at all. And that's where you want to get. That's why when you look at Captain Sully landing the airplane on the Hudson, plus he's a glider pilot, and they only get one chance to land. I mean, you don't go around in a glider. So the point is that he had practiced this stuff over and over again. And if you ever listen to the recording of him on that the transcript of him on that call, I mean, the guy is basically just flatlined. We can't do that. No, we can't do that. We can do this. Our only option is this. I mean, he's not like, oh my, his hair isn't on fire, So this is where we want to live, because there's happiness there, there's contentment there. And I think that whenever you feel in control, there's peace there, and it's when you don't feel in control, that's where anxiety comes from. So anytime you're anxious or fearful, the base emotion there is, I'm not in control of this situation. And if you're not in control of how you're thinking, then you're not in control of how you're feeling. And if you're not in control of how you're feeling, you're very uncomfortable.
So we talked a little bit about the conscious, unconscious, and subconscious aspects of our minds. I referred to earlier about sometimes when we get into the automated thinking mode or the habitual mode, our mind is wandering. And sometimes it really is needed and healthy to kind of turn our mind off. That's why things like meditation can be such powerful practices. Let's talk a little bit more about that. Why does turning off your mind work? Like, why is that so important, and how can we train ourselves to take a break from all the constant pinging that's going on in our heads?
Well, when I work with people, I tell them, look, I want 10 minutes of your day. If you can't come up with that, you need to clear your schedule. You probably spend, an hour and a half on your phone just doing this, looking at stuff that's not going to add anything to your life, and probably is going to add anxiety, to your life. So, it's very easy to practice to become more aware of your thoughts. And, in a standard meditation practice, which could be either breath-based or phrase-based, is to sit quietly in a chair in a manner like with an erect back. You're basically looking at, you don't want your body to be a distraction, when you do this. And you want to be able to sit comfortably for 10 minutes without like your hip bothering you or something like that. So, and you also don't want to fall asleep. So, and then, you close your eyes. It's good to, if you think of your eyes having laser beams coming out of them, even though your eyes are closed, it's good to look up a little bit, because it activates a certain area in your brain. It also helps you to fight drowsiness. What'll happen is, if you're drowsy, you'll find your head starts to drop and your eyes will go down. Another interesting thing about your eyes going down, I tell clients, look, when you're meeting a new client and you're going into a room, I don't want you looking at the floor. One of the reasons for that is, when you're growing up as a child, you talked about, it's the first 7 years, the brain waves are functioning in a more or less like a hypnotic suggestive thing, and it's just taking in information. When you're being reprimanded or berated, where do you look? You look at the floor, and your brain still knows the meaning of that. There was tests that were done that, to see like, well, if the way you think impacts how your body feels, does how your body is positioned, like body motion, like does that affect the hormones that your brain puts out? And the answer is yes. So if you assume a position, in other words, if you assume the position of confidence, regardless of how you might be feeling in the moment, if you assume that position, the brain begins to release testosterone, lower cholesterol or cortisol, and testosterone is like in confidence, and there's a value to it, and so your body will react in a way that it would if you were feeling confident, and it will make you feel confident. So that's why I'm saying pay attention to how you're feeling. But how do you do that? Well, we get back to the meditation. Most, as I said earlier, most people aren't really aware of what they're doing and what they're thinking. So that's what meditation does. And you're right. I think it's important to turn yourself off, to give yourself permission. Sometimes you just got to let your mind go, because otherwise you're like pulling the reins on the horses all the time and it gets tiring. So sometimes I'll take a walk and I'll just tell myself, I'm giving my mind permission to just chatter away. And but I'm giving it permission to. It's not telling me it's going to do that. I'm giving it permission to. So with the meditation, as I said, you can look up slightly, close your eyes, relax, take some slow deep breaths, and as you exhale, do a body scan. Most people, myself included, when they get tense, their shoulders come up. It's a protective position, because it's a fight or flight position. So when you exhale, let your shoulders drop and actually feel that. And then begin to either watch your body breathe or say a short phrase like, I am still. And the reason you do that is to give your mind one task. You want it to have one task, because you need a point of relativity to notice if it's not staying on task. If you tell it to think about what you need at the grocery store, well, that's not going to work. So you tell it to I want you to just pay attention to your body breathing. And what happens is, in a very short period of time, your mind says, this is really boring. I don't need to, you've got this. I'm going to go solve some problem, a report we have, I got to get done, or this conference I got to go to, whatever. And it takes off. And you go with it, because that's what you do all day long. And then there's the moment of juice, is when you wake up and you realize that you're not paying attention to your breathing, and you're thinking about a conversation you're going to have later in the day, or whatever it is. That's where everything happens, John, because that's when you stop being thought, and you become the thinker. That's when you anchor with the observer, and it's in that moment. And so it's ironic that people, when they practice meditation, they judge themselves and they say, I'm not good at it because I'm constantly chasing my mind. Well, if you're chasing your mind, you're noticing what your mind is doing. So you are actually doing very well, when you do that. And you have to let go of, this isn't a contest that you're in, where you have to get to where you have nothing but your breathing. That's all, because you're never going to be there. The guys in Tibet that are doing it, 7 hours a day, they're still dealing with that. It's just the way the mind works. And so you stop judging and you go, I'm in the practice of doing this. And if you do that, and if you didn't want to use the breath, you could just say the simple phrases I said. If you do that for 10 minutes a day, I guarantee you will not believe how it changes your mind, because all these things that are happening out here begin to lose their power. You begin to notice the stuff, and then you have the opportunity to craft a different reaction to certain situations. And we'll call that the difference between a reaction and a response. When an ambulance pulls up, they call them first responders, not first reactors. Well, why is that? Because a response has intention, conscious decision making beforehand. It knows this is what we're going to do. When we come up on the scene, this is what we're going to do. And that's where you want to be. You want to know, this situation triggers me. So what is my best behavior in this to be who I want in that situation? As I said earlier, if you don't know that beforehand, you're not going to figure it out when you get into the emotional throes of the habit because it's just too strong. So you have to have that. That's a reaction. Like the CEO, I said, when I just, you know, barked at him, he had a reaction. He didn't have a response. And so we want to be the responders. A response is deliberate. A reaction is not.
Yeah, super interesting. I note the time, Tom. This has been a fascinating conversation. I would love to continue to pick your brain, but I also need to let you go here in just a few minutes. As we wrap things up, perhaps you can close us off by just sharing a little bit of more what this can be, how this can be utilized within an organizational context. So if I'm a leader and I want, you know, to personally practice more mindfulness and I want members of my team to do so as well, you know, what are some of the ways that I can promote that, encourage that to drive, you know, the positive outcomes?
Well, I think it's important that, and I do work with teams in corporations. And one of the things that, you know, that we do is we have a plan, like we, with each person, whatever their role is in the company, we figure out, well, where are your weaknesses? Like, you know, what situations do you have? How do you react to them? And we actually write down like, okay, when this happens, this is what you're going to do. And I want you to, you know, I want you to sit in the chair, close your eyes and do it. Because, you know, they've done studies way back into the 70s with athletes that the brain doesn't differentiate between the physicality of the response and the response in the brain. As far as the brain goes, it's happening. The same hormones are released and everything. So you can actually get practice at dealing with difficult situations. And you can get repetitions in, even if you're not in the situation. Because otherwise, the only way you change a habit of behavior is when the habit shows up. You know, so
right.
You're in this place. Like if you've got a if there's certain situations where you don't do well, then those you have to wait for that situation to come up so that you can practice working against it. And but that isn't the truth. That's the point I'm making, is that you can. I think it's very important that people take this aside and say, like, they have to have an idea. Like I say, ask yourself if there's a situation that either you're not very well focused, or a situation where you get intimidated, or you know, imposter syndrome, or whatever it is. Ask yourself, you got to have a target. If I could be whoever I wanted in that moment when that happens, what does that look like? Who is that? And write it down. You have to, if you write something down, don't just think about it in your head, because there is no, that's a very abstract area. You have to have total clarity in order to write something out, to articulate it on paper. Write it out so that you have a very firm idea of this is who I want to be in the situation that I feel that I'm weak at. And then create your procedure. When this happens, you know, when I notice it, my rescue mantra is this. And then when, after I stop the inertia of the thing, then I'm going to move to this, to this, to this. And then afterwards, there's a thing in piloting called aviate, navigate, and communicate. And the reason they say that is aviate, it's very, you can use this in business. Aviate is fly the airplane first. What happens is if there's a problem, people get distracted by, well, what's causing the problem? And they forget to fly the airplane, and the airplane gets into a dangerous attitude, and many times they're killed. So the very first thing you want is an aviate. Like, you know, how am I going to handle this situation? Who do I want to be? You got to have that. Navigate is what action am I going to take that it's going to take me to someplace safe? Like, what is the, you know, where can I'm looking around, where can I put this airplane down that is my safest path from here? So what is your safest path from this moment? That's the navigate. Communication is in the aviation part, in the airplane part, is you don't have to communicate with anybody and tell them, hey, I'm going down. That's the last thing you think about, because that really has nothing to do with saving your life. In business, communicating to me is debriefing. That's when after the cycle is done, you debrief yourself. What worked? What didn't work? What could be improved? Okay. And it's just this, in the practicing mind, there's a thing I call do, observe, correct, doc. And that's where we should be in this cycle of just this non-judgmental, total equanimity refinement. You know, look at what you did. That's the execution. Then observe how the execution unfolds, and then make your corrections. Just like a basketball player shooting foul shots. He shoots the shot. That's the do. He observes the ball flight. It's in the hoop. It's off the backboard. It's left or right. Then he makes the correction. And there's no judgment. Judgment has nothing to do All judgment does is erode performance. You know, you get mad at yourself. I should have done this. I can't believe I've tried this 10 times. I should be better at all that. That conversation and self-talk is not going to make you perform better. It's just going to erode it. So non-judgment is very important.
Yeah, very well said, Tom. As we close things out for today, I just wanted to give you a moment to share with the audience how they can connect with you, find out more about your work, where they can find your books.
The best thing is, you know, I do have a website, tomsterner.com, and anybody can email me at tom@tomsterner.com. I read all my emails and I respond to them. So anybody that wants to get in touch with me for any reason, whether it's a speaking thing or working with their company or them individually, that's how you would do it.
Wonderful. Thank you, Tom, again. It's been a pleasure. I encourage the audience to reach out, get connected, find out more about what Tom can do for you. Check out his books. And as always, I hope everyone can stay healthy and safe, that you can find meaning and purpose at work each and every day. And I hope you all have a great week. Thanks for joining us for this episode of the podcast. We hope you stay healthy and safe, and please join us again soon.